right, let's talk about cervical cancer, you know. And Chris, you gave the talk on that. And I think one of the things we talked about there was that everybody expected, because of the viral etiology, that, you know, checkpoint inhibitor is going to be a home run in cervical cancer, and it seems a lot less than that. Before we talk about it, start getting into sort of how it actually plays out, Chris, can you just comment on basically what we know about the checkpoint inhibitor, specifically pembrolizumab in cervical cancer, and how it's being utilized and how it's approved?
Yeah, so that's, you know, because, like you said, the viral etiology of the disease really suggested that immunotherapy, maybe not checkpoint, but immunotherapy would have an active role. And we've seen some very promising data looking at tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes via autologous T-cell transfer. We've seen therapeutic vaccination with Advaxis, and then now with checkpoint. And the issue with pembrolizumab and the label is that in the KEYNOTE study, you know, it was a kind of a basket trial, but in the cervical cancer cohort, they found responses between 14% to 16% objective responses, and this was only in the patients that had PD-L1 expression. So the label is, at this point, it's an accelerated approval for pembrolizumab in women that have had, are in need of second-line treatment or beyond following treatment of recurrent or metastatic cervix cancer, and they have to be PD-L1 positive. So that's the way it's being used right now. The PD-L1 positivity is based on a combined positive score, which not only looks at the PD-L1 positivity on the tumor cells, but also on the lymphocytes and the macrophages in that area. And so you need a score of one or above to qualify. That, you know, with pembrolizumab being given accelerated approval, there needs to be a phase 3 randomized confirmatory trial. And that trial is fully accrued and it's maturing. The data is maturing. And that's the KEYNOTE 826 trial, bringing pembrolizumab up into the front line. So for patients with newly diagnosed metastatic cervix cancer or patients with recurrent cervical cancer that cannot be cured with the pelvic exoneration, those patients were eligible for that trial. And we're hopeful that with checkpoint, we're going to have a clinically meaningful improvement in survival.
So Mike, kind of curious, you know, it's tough for particular people in practice who are taking care of lots of different kinds of tumors. When you look at checkpoint trials to really get a feel for how valuable the benefit actually is. You know, the response rates sometimes are fairly low. I mean, even in lung cancer, where checkpoint inhibitors are used in everybody, the actual objective response rates are not that great, but you see these prolonged survivals, prolonged remissions. And I'm curious, Mike, you know, obviously the overall response rate is pretty low, but what about quality response? Have you seen patients with prolonged responses, Mike? You know, clearly tumor shrinkage and, you know, significant clinical benefit, or is it more sort of borderline?
Yeah, I think that brings up the really important issue with immune checkpoints. So the answer to that question from my perspective is the response rate's low, but those, the durations of response are so impressive, and the quality of life is terrific. I'm a big immune checkpoint fan because although the autoimmune phenomenon could be a little bit scary, we now have enough experience to know that it's fairly infrequent, and if you look for it, it's manageable. And, you know, Chris knows better than anybody that, you know, on the cervical cancer patients post 240, you know, which is sort of the standard of care, GOG-240, he was the PI on that. These patients do terrible. And yet we've got now a treatment, albeit the response rate's low, but they have a significant duration of response. So I'm very excited about it because it's a building block. We need to figure out how and why the other, you know, 85% are not responding, and we will figure that out.
So, Ursula, any thoughts about this idea of bringing, you know, obviously this is being looked at with ovary also, and we'll talk about that, but every cancer, I think, is looking at this model of combining chemo with checkpoint inhibitors. Again, lung cancer, standard of care, and squamous, non-squamous, and small cell, everybody is getting that pretty much up front. Ursula, any thoughts about cervical cancer, both the feasibility of combining it with immunotherapy, for example, this trial with the atezolizumab, and any thoughts you have about how productive this kind of strategy is going to be?
Yeah, no, I think, Neil, I think your comment about, you know, the addition of immunotherapy, certainly checkpoint blockade to chemotherapy, there's a lot of preclinical evidence that you know, you're going to kind of stimulate the immune system better, you know, with the chemotherapy on board, you know, increasing tumor antigens, increasing T cell infiltrations, et cetera. And I think, you know, there's only one way of knowing, and that's going ahead and doing the trial. I mean, I think that, you know, you'd want to sort of pick a patient population as kind of homogeneous as possible from histology, obviously, cancer site, and then kind of underlying genetic standpoint. And I, you know, clearly, you know, we're talking about Javelin 100 before, and that's taking kind of an all-encompassing epithelial ovarian cancer patient population. And I think that those are not necessarily going to be trials that are going to lead to answers that are FDA approvable at the end. I mean, I think you have to think about PARP inhibitors in ovary cancer, high-grade serous, HRD, BRCA mutated. So I think this is the kind of trial that is going to answer this question. But my concern is that, you know, I don't see that they're checking, you know, they're not, you're taking all comers here. So it's not just PD-L1 positive tumors. This trial may be in the same boat, as Javelin 100, but, you know, good for the investigators, good for the companies to support a cancer like cervical cancer, where, you know, years ago, only GOG was really doing trials, but now you've got companies interested in, which is really good.
Before we move on, as long as you brought up the Javelin trial, we were going to talk about it later, but could you just, you know, talk a little bit more about exactly what the randomization was and what they saw?
Yeah. So in Javelin 100 for newly diagnosed ovarian cancer patients, all patients had stage 3 or stage 4 disease and were randomized to 3 arms. One was carboplatin paclitaxel, just, you know, nothing added to it, nothing as maintenance. Carboplatin paclitaxel, then avelumab, a PD-L1 maintenance. And then the third arm was adding avelumab to carboplatin paclitaxel and then using avelumab as maintenance. And, you know, it was histology agnostic, you know, all comers in terms of HRD, BRCA, et cetera. And Jonathan Lederman presented, you know, it was released by a press release a few weeks ago, but then Jonathan presented the data in SGO webinar last week, really suggesting that maybe the addition of the PD-L1 inhibitor actually gave a little bit worse results. So the best arm, at least the progression-free survival, median PFS, what hadn't been reached for the carboplatin paclitaxel, but it had for the other arms. And the other worrisome part is that there was, at least in the subgroup analysis that he presented, there was not a subgroup that necessarily benefited more. For example, tumors that were PD-L1 positive, BRCA mutated cancers, there was nothing that he could cull out that those patients benefited more.
So anytime I see somebody put up a slide about the abscopal effect, I've got to ask them about it because I'm still trying to decide whether it actually is there or not. And Chris, you had this cool slide I was going to ask you about on the right, talking about that. And just keeping in mind that we do have a approved strategy of chemoradiation therapy followed by checkpoint inhibitor consolidation in non-small cell lung cancer, durvalumab, standard of care now. People speculate that maybe some of the benefit has to do with the prior radiation. In any event, Chris, going to take your shot at explaining what the abscopal effect is and whether you think it actually exists or not.
Yeah, I think it exists because if you follow the science, it makes sense. We know that chemotherapy and radiation therapy, not necessarily together, even separate, both of them increase PD-L1 expression on these tumors. And so separate from even administering a checkpoint inhibitor, there is documented abscopal effect where, for example, using stereotactic radiation or hypofractionated radiation on an oligometastasis, and, you know, oligometastases are, you know, 3 centimeters or less, you can have not only the oligometastasis respond, but you can have an area of disease outside of the radiated field respond, and this is without administering a checkpoint inhibitor. So, you know, the PD-L1 expression, you know, just drives the immune response, and so you're getting the benefit of the radiotherapy on the tumor that the oligo metastasis that it's been directed to, but then a site outside the radiation field also shrinks. It's been documented. I think it, and the fact that we know that radiotherapy can increase PD-L1 expression suggests to me that the science is there that suggests that this definitely is a real phenomenon. And people are talking about it. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I was going to ask you, in terms of clinical trial strategies that would take advantage of that, you know, post-radiation therapy, is that being looked at?
It hasn't been looked at yet, but there has been a recent SRS study that was presented at ASTRO. And I think the disease was endometrial cancer, and it was a randomized study. And even though abscopal effect was not amongst one of the endpoints, it was certainly observed in the study. And the study has an interesting acronym. I'm forgetting. It may be called the TARGET study or something. But it was a small randomized phase 2 study. And I think because of that, because of the observation of some abscopal effect, it's been hypothesis generating. And I think in future trial design, that may be something to look at. Again, it would best be done in studies that are looking at stereotactic radiation therapy.